You're listening to Ryan Anderson's Model Railcast Show with your hosts, Craig Bisgeier and Tim Harrison. We're bringing you the latest news, reviews, and interviews on the hobby of model railroading. The Model Railcast Show, keeping you on the right track.
All right, Model Railcasters, it's show 222. We're back a little bit sooner than normal. Craig, we just did this last week.
Yeah, I got whiplash. We got back so quickly.
So, Craig, has anything happened on the Housatonic in the last week?
Not a damn thing.
Yeah, kind of the same here, although I will say this goes as what I was talking about yesterday. Last week. It's been kind of an exciting week. It's the port of Paulsboro has been open now. Well, the new section, I should say, has been open now for about a week and a half. It's kind of ironic that it's really going to go well with what Bernie's talking about tonight. But basically, one of the huge things is they've just brought an asphalt plant online there. They're getting steel through this new port, and it's basically generating just a lot more traffic on what was already a fairly busy line. So it's just exciting. Anytime we get to see more trains, it's a good thing.
And success story in the 21st century.
Yeah,
that's great.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And so they've been receiving they've already, let's see, in the last week they've already received, I think, three big cargo ships. So they're doing okay for a little South Jersey port. So
yeah, are they doing mostly containerized stuff or is it other things?
You know, that's a great question. Right now it's mostly steel, and okay. I guess I'm not sure. I'm trying to figure out. And Bernie, maybe you could talk about this later. I'm trying to figure out what it is that ships would be bringing in for asphalt. I don't know if it would be oil or some kind of stone or something like that. I'm not sure. But from what I understand...
We got plenty of stone here, so I doubt it's stone.
That's true. So, now, Bernie, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
And you had a...
Hello, everybody.
Hello, Bernie.
Long time no hear, right?
Indeed.
Not. Hey, somebody's complaining, says I should be your co-host. I'm on the show too much.
Yeah, well, you know, hey, anytime I feel like taking a powder, I'll call you up.
All right, good.
Now, you, Bernie, you just had an op session. Now, was that on your, that there Aqua line? I think that's how you say it.
Aquila. It's an Indian word. I never knew how to say it, and everyone here says Aquila. It turns out they're right. It's an Indian word. I don't know what it means, but it's Aquila.
Uh-huh. Right. See that?
It means little creek by big tree. I don't know what it means.
Hey,
there you go, folks. You learn something new every day.
It's true. So what I'm curious about, and I can't remember, is where was the op session actually on the Aquia line or was it on the Pola line?
Well, we had actually three op sessions in 2 days.
Mm.
And every Pola is getting all the love. Aquia line is starting to feel jealous.
Ah.
Mm. Everybody comes down here and they're like, oh, well, what do you want to do? I want to do Pola. I want to do Pola. Well, we can't all do Pola. It only can take two people. So somebody's got to work the Aquia line. So the first Thursday, the op session was Paul Dulkus, Matt Thompson, and Pete LaGuardia.
Okay.
Who's, if you watch the video on YouTube, you'll hear LaGuardia talking with his New York accent, man. You know what I mean? He's got a bad New York accent. He's from New York. I think he's from Brooklyn. But anyway, so the way it shook out was Pete and Matt operated Pola, and Paul and I did Aquia. But then... we only had about four. We just did like a little test on Aquia, but Paul did make history because he ran the first official trains from Aquia Landing out and back.
Oh.
Really? Wow.
Aquia Landing only has half of its track in, and we don't have the Y in yet. We don't have the tracks on the wharf or on Burnside's, but we do have a little mini yard there.
Okay.
So Paul took we had like a 4-car train that left Aquia, picked up, dropped off some cars at Brook. Picked up a car, we dropped off a car at Brook, dropped off the car at Stoneman's, and on the way back, he picked up a car, actually took a different train back, so it was 11 out, 12 back, and picked up a car. So we did a little bit of switching and ran the train. So that, Paul actually made history, even though Pola was getting all the love, but Paul goes down to the history books as the first train out of Aquia.
Well, there you go.
So
congratulations, Paul.
Yeah. Well, Paul really likes Pola, though. He wanted to do Pola. He loves the modern switching. He really likes that layout. A lot of people apparently do, because the next day, Phil Hoffman came over. Phil used to live in Maryland, and it's just a small world, because Phil I knew from the N-Scale stuff. He's an N-Scaler. And then one day I meet this guy, David Hoffman, in Atlanta. And David Hoffman lives in Mississippi, and I've told you about this guy before. And David Hoffman is Phil's uncle. He's Uncle David. And Dave Hoffman was the manager of the NASA Railroad down at Cape Canaveral.
Oh, I remember you told us about him.
Sure. Yeah, so it's like, so it's such a small world. So Phil was up here. Now, here's the other thing. I'm working on electric grid and space satellites is one of the things we're looking at for early warning of solar storms. So I contacted Phil because he works at NOAA, and NOAA is a National Oceanographic Association or something. I don't know what the A stands for. Anyway, he got me in touch with the space weather guys. So anyway, he was in town, so he did an op session, and he wanted to operate Pola. So Pola was getting all the love.
Well, it is a pretty cool layout, that's for sure. But the quiet line, you know, the quiet line's beautiful, though. I mean, I tell you what, I would operate on either one. It just
The quiet line is still in my heart. I tell you what, yeah.
Well, Craig, and you guys have not seen a Aquia landing with the track.
I'm dying.
There's going to be a lot of one of the Y in there, and there's going to be basically four sidings to switch at the wharfs. So one gets car ferry cars off the car ferry, plus boats are loading things.
Mm-hmm.
And the other wharf doesn't have a car ferry, but it gets boats. So you'll have like cars coming in. And what I can't figure out and or decide is, should I have a separate crew that works Aquia Landing, or what I think the prototype did was every train goes down to the wharfs and makes up their own train and then leaves.
Hmm.
The drawback to that would be that the crews would have to be sequential.
Right.
So the trains leave, and I think that's kind of what the prototype did, although I can look at the records, and it's different crews, like train one is the outbound train, and train three is the next outbound train. It's odd, they're out, and even are back.
Sure.
And they have different crews, so I can tell, and you can tell some guys go out, come back, and then do it again, because the names of the engineers are listed.
Oh, okay.
So I get the impression that that's what happens. So the way I think we might work it when we actually really start operating it, basically I think two crews is optimal, is we'll start one crew in Aquia, and the other crew will start out of Falmouth.
Okay.
And then they will actually meet, which is not exactly how the prototype did it.
Right.
But I think that would be interesting. And then we can run like an extra also. If we have a sixth, you know, fifth and sixth guy,
mm-hmm.
they would take, say, extra 11, follow 11 out. But they all have to be ready to go because you have to be within 5 minutes of the other guy's time.
Of course.
So anyway, it's kind of tricky how we're going to figure it all out. Once we get it all up and running, that's part of the fun of owning a layout.
Oh, sure, without a doubt.
The other thing I did on Pola, though, which was kind of cool, was I had been filling out my switch list by hand, and after doing it several times now, we probably had about 10 sessions on Pola already, I said, you know, I'm writing the same thing over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
So I made two, I typed two on my computer, and those would be like, you know, plan A, out and back, and it's very easy to just fiddle the cars where they need to be, so I don't need car cars. I actually may do an article about this, like an alternate way to set up an op session on a small layout, which is just basically have four or five switch lists already made and just pick the one. This one's a hard one. This one's an easy one. This is for mm-hmm. an experienced operator, that kind of thing.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Interesting idea. Okay.
So that was the op session. And then do you want an update on what else I'm doing?
Yeah, sure. Why don't we go into that right now? Yeah, that'll be good.
All right. So I'm laying the track at Aquia. And that involves, and Craig, I was thinking about you tonight, because tonight I was putting another coat of polyurethane on the water.
Ah.
And I remember when you guys, I bought $100 worth of Unreal water to mix and pour.
Okay.
But I'm a little hesitant to do it. I should have just bit the bullet and did it when I was in Florida. I let it cure while I was gone, and that would have been over. So I'm trying multiple layers of the polyurethane.
Okay.
So I put down two layers just kind of to seal everything, and then I was going to put the pilings in and then pour.
Right.
But I put the two layers down, and then I started – now I'm up to coat five. I'm painting the next layers down, which means I'm painting around the pilings, which is kind of a pain. But the pilings in the middle of the pier are just not visible.
Right.
Can't see them because they're only, my pilings are only half inch high.
Okay.
So really, I don't even have to put gloss coat in there if I don't want to. But I'm doing
probably
it
not.
Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the right thing to do. So yeah.
Yeah, but I was thinking about you guys when you did that. You used the power mixer and you basically made foam.
Yes.
So I said, I don't want to do that. I don't want that to happen to mine. Anyway, so we'll see what happens. I did buy $100 worth of Unreal Water. I like Unreal Water. I figured I better get a fresh bottle. You know, you don't want to pour old stuff and everything.
Sure.
And so maybe I'll do that once it's – because to me, nothing looks like model – you know, no model water looks like real water except that resin. The resin looks the best.
The resin does look the best. That's true.
So I'm thinking I'm going to pour some resin. I'm going to bite the bullet and do it.
Okay. And remember, if you do, it's no big deal to go back after. If it doesn't look quite right, because I often find it looks too still, so it's a really easy thing to go back, you know, after it's done and it's cured, to go over with some gel gloss medium.
Oh, yeah.
And just
yeah.
put a few waves in here and there, and that's a piece of cake.
So. Right. And what the plan is, I like to have my boats movable.
Okay.
For pictures.
You don't want to make it too lumpy then.
Yeah, so I'm not going to make it too lumpy. But I could, like you said, once the boats are sort of in place, go around with the gel and just kind of leave a little edge around the boats so that they can come in and out.
Yeah, that'll work.
So that was a big – that's kind of – you know, sometimes you get hung up on a little thing, like, ooh, what should I do next? And you just sort of drags out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that's got me kind of dragged out.
I get
so
that way about cleaning, yeah.
Well, while I was worrying about that, I said, well, let me go work on Pola. That's the beauty of having two layouts.
Yeah.
If I get bored or tired with one, I just roll over and work on the other one. So
nice.
For Pola, after the book was done, I decided to add a little extension by the borax plant.
Okay.
And what will happen is the borax plant was kind of compressed before, and now the borax plant is going to be much more closer to prototype. So there'll be room for 8 hopper cars on each side of the loading shed because it's like a silo. It looks like a grain elevator, but it's for borax.
Okay.
So you put in your you can switch in up to 8 hopper cars, and then the fact track where the factory is that gets box cars and tank cars and also hopper cars, that has room for 4 cars now. So that'd be 12 cars just for the borax factory.
Okay.
And then I decided, well, I'm at it. I'm expanding. I want to put a big boat in here, a big ship. And the picture that I have shows a bulk carrier called the Boron Explorer docked at the pier there, and it's getting borax loaded into it because the borax is exported. The borax is mined in the desert of California, comes in trains, on usually in hopper cars, and there are these special copper cars that say borax on them,
yep.
And Athern made them. Mm. So I've got the exact cars I need for this factory.
Okay.
And then there's some other ones that they lease from TCMX, and so I had to decal those. So that's pretty cool. So yeah. I'm looking at the boat, the bulk carrier, the Boron Explorer, in HO scale would be 83 inches long.
That's pretty big.
That's pretty big. So I poked around the internet. And by the way, that is not even one of the big ones. That's like a 40,000 deadweight tons, or deadweight tons, I mean. They can go up to 300,000 deadweight tons, these ore carriers and stuff. So they have different names for them. And I don't think I mentioned this in the book, but they have like Panamax and Cape Max. And mm-hmm. Super Panamax. So those are the big ones. The ones that on my end I'm looking at is called a Handy size. And a Handy is actually the most common bulk carrier, and they go from like 15,000 to 30,000 deadweight tons. And I found one that's still active. It's called the Sir Albert, although I'm going to rename it. It's probably the Alchem Explorer. And it's 16,000 deadweight tons.
Okay.
And it's 62 inches long.
Wow. That's still pretty substantial.
And 10 inches wide. So I called up, I was going to Florida, or we like go down there, help in-laws and stuff and play some golf. And it's kind of fun. They live right
sure.
on the beach, Daytona. And I called up my brother, who's in Melbourne, and I said, hey, Rob, you want to do a little woodworking job? And my brother wants to play golf. So, of course, we have to play golf. He loves golf. So he goes, what do you need? I said, well, I need some poplar planks. 3/4 inch, 10 inch wide. He goes, oh, I'll have to glue them up. I better get them now. So he goes out and buys all the wood and glues them up before I even get there. And
nice.
Planes them, too. He's got a complete wood shop. Now, Craig, you will love this.
Okay.
He is into woodworking. He's bonsai and woodworking. Those are his hobbies and golf. He made his own hand planes.
Really? Wow.
He made
that's impressive.
When he lived in Houston, he made like these old antique shooting boards and all these other things. I don't even know what they're called. He made his own spokeshave. I am carving
oh, wow.
the wood on my hull using a handmade spokeshave that he made.
No kidding. Wow.
So what he would do is he would make the mask, and he took them to a foundry in Houston. They made like 50 for him, and then he kept – and they even have the name, his name on them. Like, Stanley. Instead of saying Stanley, they say Compendi.
Nice.
Or they have the family.
It's so cool.
They have the family coat of arms on them. Anyway, so that is cool. I mean, so anyway, we go down there after golf, and like the girls' wives go in there and do their thing, and we got the bandsaw out. We glued up these things. I had the templates printed on my computer up here. So when I got down there, he gets out his bandsaw. He's got an Inca bandsaw, and we swap the blades. He's got this like little tiny thin blade that goes on the bandsaw, so you can do nice curves.
Right.
And so we cut out the ship in the three-quarter inch layers, and then glued them up, and then I mailed them home, and they were waiting for me when I got back here.
That's
so
great.
That's the boat.
Well, I'm very impressed.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah. So, and then he goes, he sees a picture on Facebook I put it about a week later. He goes, "You aren't done with that yet?" Like, no, this project is taking a couple weeks.
Just a couple.
Well, the hard part's done. The hull was the hard part, and I went out my backyard with belt sander. And everybody knows the belt sander is the tool that takes a little tiny job and makes it into a big job.
Sure.
And basically, I was going at it for about 3 hours on a Saturday afternoon, and it started going to 5 o'clock. And my neighbor opens her window. She's not feeling well. She goes, "How long is this going to go on?" I said, "Okay, I'll stop with the power tools." And then I sanded it down, and I wondered again. This is another point. You get into a stage like, what do I do next? How do I seal up this hull? And I looked into finishing resins and those things. You know, like guitar guys use it to finish.
Sure. Yep.
But since this does not have to be waterproof, and it's not going to be like getting banged around, it doesn't have to be super hard. So I just went with putty and high build filler.
Okay. Well, that'll get the job done. Yeah.
Yeah, well, Rob was worried. He said, "You know, those cracks where the glue is, they may eventually show." And I said, "Well, I don't think so. And even if they do, they're right on the seam lines of the ship."
Well, so that it'll just blend right in.
I'll just paint, make sure. What I'm going to do to show all the little panel lines is I'm going to just paint them on.
Okay.
And so I'll make sure I paint right on where the glue joints were.
Right. And you know, if it ever does separate a little bit, just add a little bit of rust right off that line. Make it look like it's a rust line. It'll just fade right away.
There you go.
You won't even see it.
Boom. There it is.
Boom. There you go.
Anyway, so that's the boat. So
outstanding.
Pole has been expanded. Acquire's going. Craig, I may have to call in a chip on you. You might have to build a car for me or two.
Yeah, we talked about that the last time I saw you. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, what I thought for that is SMR Trains was doing kits.
Okay.
And I said, well, last time I did this for with Dave Emery, I just sent him a pile of parts, no plans or anything. He freaked out. So I thought, okay, if I do this again, I'll just buy some kits and farm them out and let the people build the kits.
Okay.
At least they have instructions and stuff.
Well, that's helpful.
And he did a nice job on those cars, Dave Schneider.
Dave's a real craftsman. You know, he's done one or two things for me, too. And like that, I mean, obviously, that the cigar plant on my railroad, he did. And that's a gorgeous piece. It's one of the most beautiful models on my railroad. So, yeah, he's a really artist. He's good that way.
Well, actually, I was talking about Dave Schneider did the cars, but Dave Emery did a car for me, but Schneider's doing the kits. I got to watch all too many days. My boss is Dave. My colleague is Dave. We got too many days.
Yeah.
He's not here, man.
We're going to have fun with this one.
I have to see this quote for the show. Dave's not here.
Dave's not here.
I can already, I know I'm going to have to steal the WAV files and insert them in on the game.
Three, two, one.
All right. Well, Model Railcasters, as you've heard, we've got Bernie Kempinski on, and Bernie, you wrote a book. I read that book, and we'd love to talk about that book. And Craig, it's going to be appropriate to have you on because, you know, part of your model railroad definitely includes a marine terminal, if you will.
It certainly does.
Yeah. So the book is called Waterfront Terminals and Operations, published by Comback Publishing. And Bernie, I love all your books, but this one, maybe it's because I love maritime history, but this one I really enjoyed. Just give us a brief overview then of your book and any background information going into it that you'd like to share.
Well, first, going back to Craig's layout, I would have loved to had something from Craig's layout in the book and Dave Ramos's, but those guys never got me any pictures. So
I didn't know about it until you told me. It would have been great. I would have loved that. But
I mentioned it to you a couple of times, but you forgot.
Did you? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right, well, then that is a shame because I would love to have been at it.
Well, the one thing especially, I know that your layout's not that far along in terms of, like, pretty pictures, but I love the design of Wilson Point. I actually like your layout design in general, but I thought that would have been good. But anyway, don't feel too bad because I had too much stuff as usual. So anyway, the book is Waterfront Terminals and Operations. That is a good title for the book because that's kind of what it covers. And, you know, they say, I love all my children. Yes, I love all my children. I love all my books. But I agree with you, Tim. I love this one so far the best. I also like marine terminal and topics. I actually built my first module, which was Chase Marine Terminal, which was a small container terminal on an Entrac module. So I've been doing this for a while. And, in fact, on the layout that I built for the book, which is called POLA, Port of Los Angeles, I freelanced a little terminal on the far left, which I call Chase Marine Terminal. It's actually Chase Marine 3. It's the third time I've done a Chase Marine. And just to get equal love, the boat that's docked at Chase Marine is the Danica Marie, which is named after my daughter. Right?
Gotcha.
And the barge is named Alicia. The gas bar is Alicia. And there's a row coach on the layout that's Violetta's meatballs. So we got everybody covered, so nobody's upset.
Nice.
There you go. That's great.
Anyway, so what else? What do you want to know?
Well, you know, maybe I'll just, the rest will sort of come, although you've always fascinated with it, and I am too, and it's really, that goes well with question number one I had, and that's, because I want to get in right into it, how significant is the combined rail and maritime system really even to our way of life? And if you could also harken back to maybe what some of the early examples of the maritime aspect of trawling are.
Yeah. That's the first chapter in the book is a historical overview, so you're basically covering the first chapter. And one of the things I say in the book is that the United States is a maritime nation. Well, when you think of like amber waves of rain and purple mountains, majesty, yeah, that's part of the United States too. We're surrounded by three oceans, basically, or two oceans in the Gulf of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since the early colonial days, the United States has been a maritime nation. Our sailors were famous before the Revolution. Our shipbuilders were great. If you look at the early cities along the United States, many of them are at the furthest point of navigation on a river. So like Albany, Washington, D.C., which is really Georgetown. It's right next to Washington.
Right.
Alexandria, where I live, was a major seaport. Richmond is at the last point of navigation on the James River. So it was very common to – it was just important. It was the way people moved around. By the time of the Civil War – Missouri was the second most populated state in the Confederacy because of all the people that lived along the Mississippi because it was reachable. Kentucky was developed along the rivers. So we have the ocean and we have these rivers. So we are a maritime nation. During the Civil War, there was a grain boom going on in the United States, and in Europe there was a grain shortage. So the railroads were shipping grain to the East Coast ports to be exported. And some of those railroads on the north, the further north you got from the war, the less they even knew there was a war going on because too busy making money. And that's continued to this day. The United States is still a major grain exporter.
Mm-hmm.
The facts are in the book. You can go through the numbers. But, for example, we produce something like 2% of the world's rice. I think it is. I got to look these numbers up. But we export 10% of the world's rice.
Wow.
We export more corn than anybody, even though 85% of corn we grow is used domestically.
Wow.
So the last 15% that we grow still is more than everybody else exports. We are still the world's leading wheat producer, even though we only make 10% of the world's wheat. We make 2% of the world's rice, but we export 10% of the rice. We do 34% of the world's soybeans. So in terms of grain, it's big. We export coal, mostly metallurgical coal. Is people think of coal, they think of like one commodity, but there's actually many, many types of coal. And you could broadly group it into steam and metallurgical. We still have a lot of metallurgical coal. Our steam coal is down, probably because the price of oil is down. But we still export a good amount. We actually import a little bit of steam coal, too, which is kind of interesting. It's cheap for some of the Gulf Coast power plants right on the coast to get their coal delivered by ship than by rail.
Oh, okay.
Interesting.
Mm. Yeah. So somebody asked me, I gave a talk last week, and somebody asked me, I might be skipping ahead, like, what is the most important advance that's made? Like, he was asking about container shipping.
Mm-hmm.
But it applies to shipping in general. The most important factor is operational, is profit, it's mm-hmm. cost. That is the most important factor. Technology is really not that revolutionary. It's the same thing with trains. There are some major – it's how cheaply can you perform the transportation service.
Right.
And ships compete with trucks now, not in the old days, but do now, and they compete with rail. So you get a lot of different combos depending on what gives you the lowest cost. And right. during the days of regulation – the ships could actually do a bit better because of the regulation. It was harder to get sort of innovative ideas through. But with right. deregulation, right now the trucks are pretty much dominant because they dominate on service, not so much cost, but they dominate service. And the rails are pretty cheap. So the ships in the United States, at least, are not doing a lot of intercoastal or short sea shipping.
Gotcha.
Most of it is coming from overseas and going out. There are a few niche markets, and there's a thing called the Jones Act, which I don't think I mentioned this in the book, but the Jones Act says that any ship that just does inter-U.S. trade has to be built in the United States.
Really?
Oh, okay.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's the Jones Act. And so you have what they call Jones Act trade, which is just trade that goes from American port to American port. Like, for example, oil that comes from Alaska that's going to Los Angeles, that would be has to be done on a U.S.-made tanker. So as a result, there is only one shipyard left in the United States that can build sort of the big ships, and that's down in San Diego.
Oh.
And they have to partner with Korean companies to keep up with the technology.
Hmm.
So it's another example of how the United States is losing its technological workforce because of everything can be done cheaper overseas. And this applies to computers, and you know, Microsoft couldn't make mice in the country anymore because they didn't have the toolmakers, and it also applies to
right.
ships. So,
right.
But the Jones Act was established to help protect our shipbuilding industry.
Okay, interesting.
So whether you believe in protectionism or not, we won't get to the politics of it, mm-hmm. but there's still that aspect too. But it's a pretty minor aspect. When I was in Port of Palm Beach, they were talking about sugar trade, where they were getting sugar and molasses from Florida and shipping it to Boston. So that would be an example of Jones Act trade.
Gotcha. All right, cool.
Mm-hmm.
So to answer your question, yes, it is very important.
Right.
It still is.
Right. Very good.
It's just the patterns are shifting.
Gotcha.
The pattern shift. Right now, we are largely importing. We import finished products, and we import raw materials. So basically, we're a colony.
Right.
That makes sense. Makes sense.
You know, we're China's colony, essentially. We can talk about this later, but because it's cheap to send stuff out of the country, because most of these containers going out are empty anyway,
right?
You could ship whatever you want out of this country for practically free. So
wow.
We were there. We saw a container full of rags being shipped out.
No kidding.
Used rag. Wow. And that was going to be made into probably paper.
Right. Okay. That's usually what rag is for. It.
Yeah. So anyway, and there's a book called, I think it's called like The Nation of Junk or something, which talks about how we basically export our junk and get nice stuff from the rest of the world.
Wow. Well, you know, that's resourceful. What I wanted then to do was go ahead and look at a question I had about Chapter 2, because you start getting right into what ships move, and that's the break bulk aspect. And that's a fascinating term, because I think it basically has what I'd like you to do, actually, is define the term and maybe then touch a little bit on how it's changed. And then I'm just curious now if there's any ports might even specialize in that type of event.
Ah, that's in the book. Okay, so break bulk. It is it's a nautical phrase, and it's really kind of silly, but it means to break bulk. So the verb to break bulk meant to unload a ship.
Right.
And so the cargo that they were loading got shortened to, well, that's break bulk cargo. And so prior to World War II, all cargo pretty much was break bulk, except for maybe like oil tankers and a few other things. And break bulk is little cargo that was loose, generally unclassified. So bananas, boxes of shoes, stereos, radios, bags of cocoa, mm-hmm. bags of coffee, anything that was shipped in ships, and it was either going to be put in a barrel or in a box or in a bag or a sack. And believe it or not, that lasted straight up to the 50s until the containerization thing happened. Lumber was another break bulk cargo. So once the containerization revolution happened, break bulk evolved. It's still a very important aspect, but now break bulk is cargo that doesn't fit in a container or is better suited to some other way of shipping. For example, rice is shipped in large, like, four-ton bags. They have these little hooks on the top, or loops. And then they bring in the hook, and they hook onto the loops, and they lift the whole bag of rice and just plop it in the ship. And, you know, it conforms to the mold, and it works pretty nice.
Very cool.
So break bulk is still a modern, very important cargo. There are ports that specialize in it. A lot of ports will have a break bulk terminal as well as a container terminal and maybe a mineral terminal or an oil terminal. Like Los Angeles has many of each. But the smaller ports, Olympia is a good example. They break bulk. They ship lumber. Olympia, Washington, ship lumber. They ship bags of a chemical that's used. It's like a granular chemical. It comes in bags. I forget right. the name of it. The lumber is kind of interesting because we export a lot of lumber, especially from the Pacific Northwest, and it goes in logs. So, really? You know, if you go up there, you can see the logs floating down the river, you know, the classic. Do you ever see the movie Sometimes a Great Notion?
Can't say that I have.
Great movie. Got to see it. It's about the lumber industry in the Pacific Northwest. There's a gut-wrenching scene in that movie. But anyway, so that whole idea of, you know, men running on the logs in the river and all that, that's still done, and then they come on these big ships and big logs, you know, and the ships get stacked way up because the logs are pretty light with logs, and that's what you'll see at Olympia and up in the Pacific Northwest, too. So break bulk is a biggie. Windmills are now another break bulk commodity.
Yeah, actually, that was a great term. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. I just didn't add it as well.
Well, we have a little chapter on windmills in the book because I thought they were really cool. And you can get them N scale and HO scale.
Mm-hmm.
Big reactor parts, like if you're doing what they call project cargo. So project cargo is cargo for a particular project. So maybe you're doing an oil refinery and you're buying your pieces in China or India or something. They'll come in big, big tanks and things. And 200, 300 tons at a time. And so those would come on a break bulk ship. Some vehicles are considered break bulk, but they can also go on railroads, depending on how they're doing.
Yeah.
Let's see, what else is good break bulk cargo? Oh, transformers are another biggie, because they're very heavy.
Right.
And another cool one are yachts. Yachts are moved around on break bulk ships.
Oh, now that's ironic.
So... yeah, well, if you buy a yacht, you know, and it's built, the yachts are made of the world, but say you got a yacht that was made in Sweden, or maybe, you know, say Sweden or Denmark, they still make yachts over there, and you want to bring it down to West Palm Beach, they'll put it on a ship, haul it down there
right.
for you.
And that makes sense, because otherwise you'd be getting a used ship if they just sell.
Oh, it's wear and tear, you know.
No, if it's 100 or 30, or whatever it is, it may not be capable of going across the ocean. It might not have enough fuel.
That makes sense. Now, ports that handle break bulk, I know that actually I live right near one, South Jersey Ports, and that's built the old New York shipbuilding lots. But I was showing you some pictures of that the other night on Facebook. Now, the Seaview layout in your book, is that one layout that's designed around a break bulk terminal, or is that the terminals in general?
Well, they do a lot of break bulk because they don't have grain or mineral, and they don't really do a lot of containers either. So they are break bulk. They also do cars, though. They import a lot of cars up there. So they come in by railroad ship, which look like big floating boxes. They're the ugliest ships made. And they're full of cars. And when you think about the value of all the cars on board, it's amazing. And a couple of years ago, one of them with a bunch of Volvos sank. That was coming from Europe. Another one with Mazdas had problems. It like partially didn't capsize. But it was like listing at about 40 degrees.
Boy.
And so when they got to the port, listen to this, all the cars taken off the ship and sent directly to shredders.
Oh, you got it. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, because
they
cannot
be sold. Nope. They could not even sell the parts.
Wow. Right.
The reason is that the company would not assume the liability if a part was damaged and someone bought a part and got hurt. They didn't want a liability. So everything was salvaged. It wasn't wasted. You know, so the tires went and got recycled. And one of the things we do in the United States is we recycle a lot of steel. The number one export from Los Angeles is steel. And so the engine blocks are considered high-quality steel, so they got ground up and shipped back to North Korea probably to be remade into a ship or something. And, you know, but it was kind of cool. You could not sell the cars. Even though they really they didn't get wet, they just, like, all got tilted over.
Right. They probably crashed into each other, you know, like that. So, although they do lock some of them down. They do. I had the opportunity 10 years ago to go onto a Ro-Ro ship down in Newark. And it was a fascinating experience. And the amazing, the decks can actually be raised and lowered inside the ship in order to make more room, you know, depending on how tall the cars are. It's like a giant parking lot. It's really wild.
Exactly.
And yeah, you're right. They're some of the ugliest ships you'll ever see.
Well, Norm Wolf set me up in Norfolk. We got a tour of the UNS Watson, mm-hmm. which is a military railroad designed to carry vehicles in case of a war where we need to get our tanks over there quick. Right. And so I got a nice tour of that ship, and I was allowed to take pictures. And when I was still planning on doing the Port of Beaumont, which is also in the book, I was going to actually build something. But these suckers are 900 feet long, so mm-hmm. that would have been 11 feet long in HO scale.
Yeah, they're big.
There's a picture. The picture in the book compares the modern ships, various sizes, and like if you're doing O scale, you have to have a 28 foot long ship.
Right. It's just amazing. That was one of my favorite pictures in the book.
About as long as most people's house.
Yeah. Or you could make a bride on that damn thing.
Well, yeah, you could.
Had a 28-foot, or well, ours was 27-foot boat, and when I was in high school, my dad had a boat.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, yeah, side question here, but I'm guessing, you know, you're talking about that ship that had a 40-degree list. I'm guessing most cargo ships being built to mercantile standards probably can't counter-flood, or can they to a degree?
They have some capability of doing that, and that's probably what they had to do to write this ship. Although, you know, I don't remember the details, but I suspect, I could be wrong about this, that they abandoned and then a salvage crew came in and did what it had to do.
Gotcha.
There was one in the Bay of Biscay about 3 years ago, a Ro-Ro, that had, or maybe it might have been a ferry, but it had that problem and it got abandoned. And it was like a hazard to navigation because it was listing about, 45 degrees, and it was heading for the, the Spanish coast. They helicoptered in the salvage crew, and they did what they had to do, and they got it secured.
Wow.
So, yeah. I don't know. Would you want to stay on a ship that's 45 degrees on its side, and you don't know? I would put my life jacket on at least.
Oh, at the very least, yeah.
Man. All right, well, moving then on to question three, and we've touched on it a little bit already, and that is grain. Yeah, and I guess one of those things that you deservedly just devote a whole chapter to. And again, I think it's kind of hard for us to grasp just how, not only how significant the grain industry is, but also it is a sensitive product to ship, isn't it, Bernie?
Yeah, it has a shelf life, has to be protected. The grain elevators do a good job. That's one of the reasons they kind of evolved. Well, as I say in the book, grain shipping is as old as grain growing. And the grain elevators were probably like earthen jugs. And they started shipping it. But in the United States, the grain elevator industry really kind of centers around Buffalo because of the way the Erie Canal and the Great Lakes came together at Buffalo. So Buffalo was very prominent. And, for example, the first mechanical unloader for ship-to-grain elevator was invented in Buffalo. It was called a marine leg. And it was quickly adopted around the world. But as the canals expanded, like the Welland Canal, and Buffalo kind of ebbed and flowed, mm-hmm. and Chicago became more important, and the grain elevators again. And the innovation that made Chicago so important really was, well, two things. Railroads were there, so grain was being funneled into Chicago. And they came up with the grain grading system, G-R-A-D-I-N-G, grading. So this is grade A, grade B, whatever. And by that, farmers could combine their crops, so you didn't have to ship stuff in sacks anymore.
Okay.
And then farmers would get, you know, they would sell their grain and they would get a receipt And then the farmer wanted money, so he'd go trade that receipt. And that's how the grain futures industry developed, which is still in Chicago. You know, the commodities exchange, and now they do pork bellies and everything else. If you want to know about that, just go watch the movie Trading Places.
Mm.
You guys have seen that movie, right? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So the commodity trading industry is kind of centered in Chicago, and it's all because of the grain elevators and the railroads were there. So grain is real big. I won't talk, you know, in detail about it. Jeff Wilson did a book on grain, and I have a chapter on how it interfaces with the marine side. But we still export a lot of grain. It evolves like everything. And right now, the major grain exporting places in the United States are along the Mississippi and in the Pacific Northwest. The East Coast grain elevators, which they were, every port had 3 or 4 grain elevators, that's kind of gone away, mostly because the grain growing is sort of shifts around too. It's shifted more to the west. And those were older designs and weren't as modern and as efficient as sort of these ones on the Mississippi. A lot of loops, a lot of grain loops, so you can do unit trains, whereas the East Coast ones tended to be little switcher type things. Although Beaumont, Texas, which is still active, has like 6 cars at a time you have to switch, which I think is really cool. I talk about that in the book. Yeah, so grain is a biggie too, and we have big bulk carriers that carry grain. They're also on the Great Lakes, they're on the oceans. We export a lot of grain. We, in some ways, you could say we're the world's breadbasket, although it's not as true as it used to be. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah. All right, cool.
And I guess we should mention, I don't talk too much about it in the book, but ethanol is a biggie that's shipped by rail. And it requires a lot of corn shipment by rail. So, but we're not exporting a lot of ethanol, as far as I know. I didn't really look into that in the book, and I haven't read about it. So, I don't think that's a big export product. We do export a lot of corn, though.
Right. That makes sense.
Well, the grain elevator makes a cool rail marine industry to model, and the book has a couple examples of them. And it's just because it's a neat structure. And it can get a lot of switching, as I was mentioning earlier. So and there have been a lot of people that have done it, including Model Railroader did one, the Continental Grain. You guys remember that one?
Oh, yeah.
That was that's a sea export, well, lake. It's on the lakes. So lake boats would come in and get the grain from the trains and then go out to wherever they were going. So I have a couple examples in the book of people that have modeled grain elevators, and I show the Beaumont as a grain exporting port because a lot of the rail activity that goes to Beaumont is grain if you're not doing the oil terminal on the other side of the river, which is humongous. So we left, ignoring oil, which is really the biggie,
right.
But grain is the next biggie. And then they have a nice break bulk terminal that happens to ship the military vehicles, so it's a pretty cool spot.
Great.
Yeah, sounds like a great place to go
model
visit.
The reason I did not model it in the book, for the book, was I didn't have the pictures for Beaumont.
Okay.
And I did have the pictures for L.A.
So it's kind of settled there. Yeah,
and there was one other thing I really liked about L.A. Then that Beaumont, the most of the on-port switching is handled by the local railroad, which is cool for a small railroad because you only need I think they had GP15s, small blue engines. But one thing you got that's cool about the L.A. project was you do see the big six-axle BNSF trains and the Port of Pacific Harbor Line trains, and I kind of wanted to get some of that big modern power in the book, in pictures.
Yeah.
And I actually tapped Ramon to come over and do a photo shoot with his, because he has all the BNSF power that you could possibly
want.
Sure,
he
says he wants to come over and do another photo shoot, so we're going to be doing that soon.
Fantastic.
So that's one of the other reasons I picked L.A., and it was mostly for the pictures, though.
That makes sense. So, Bernie, for our branch line piece here, before we go into more details, the cargo obviously can't go anywhere fresh without being loaded or unloaded, and I wanted you to just talk in basic ways when that was done. I did see some terms that I was familiar with in the book, like cranes and elevators, but some other ones definitely was not familiar with, at least at first. And obviously, I want people to buy the book, so you don't have to go exhaustive here. But I saw terms like Hewlett unloaders and Barneys, and so why don't you go ahead and talk to us about those?
Okay, the book is organized, the first 3 chapters of the book are organized by commodity, and then the specialized machines that handle those commodities are talked about in each of those chapters. So I mentioned the marine legs for the grain elevators, for the coal, you had two things. You had two sets of machines that evolved, the loaders and the unloaders. And then for break bulk, you had an assortment of cranes. The earliest one before railroads was like basically a big hamster wheel.
Okay, wow.
And you would put a man, you put men inside them, sometimes a horse, and they would run or walk, and then through leverage, that would get the winches to winch up the cargo. There were a few examples of those around the world. So that we have cranes for break bulk. But let's go back to coal, because you had mentioned Ulitz and such. So the first coal loaders were basically wheelbarrows on planks. Mm-hmm. And once the ships got too big, they came up with ore docks that used gravity and chutes. So you elevated the train, and it dumped the coal or the ore into a bin. And then the boat came in, and you lowered the chute into the boat, and you would load the boat that way. And so as a result, an interesting side shoot of this is that the lake boats on the Great Lakes, which predominantly did ore and grain, they all have their hatches sized for, I think it's 24 feet, because all the bins were built at 24-foot intervals. So that weakens the ship. So they are not that good at going in the big ocean. So the big ocean ships have smaller hatches and fewer of them. And then there's like more deck space around them. So that's one way you can tell. So a couple days ago, a little anecdote, somebody was looking at my ship that I'm working on now, which is an ocean-going bulk carrier, and they said, it looks like the Edmund Fitzgerald. And he's a friend of mine, and I said, well, you fail ship identification. Because the Edmund Fitzgerald was a Laker. This boat looks nothing like the Edmund Fitzgerald. You know, it has 24-inch hatches. This one has different. This has a bulbous bow. The Herald had a bluff bow. So anyway, it's just like in trains, we can tell an SD-40 from an SD-50 and so on. The ship guys, they're all specialized and they can tell one from another. So you had going back to the loading devices, so you went for these ore bins, and those are still used on the Great Lakes and other places. But for coal, another type of thing evolved, because the ore bins are good for ore. But coal does not like to be dropped, because it breaks. And when customers specify lump coal, which are big chunks of coal, they don't want it to come in little pieces. So you have to treat the coal more gently. And so you have to come up with machines that, when loading the ship, they have to sort of have an arm or tube that goes down to the ship and, you know, more gently places the coal in the bin. Now, if it's ground up coal, that's not an issue. So there are some places where you just dump the whole car into a rotary bin and do it that way. So ore bins were used for coal, but then you had these other devices, like for loading a ship, called a McMiller dumper, which was a way that the car would be elevated. And this is where your Barney comes in. So you would park a car at the foot of an elevated trestle. The Barney would grab the car. The Barney was like a little coupler that was connected to a set of wheels that almost could go under the car, kind of. And then the Barney would either be cable drawn, or sometimes they were electrically powered. And they would push the car up to the top of this, what looks like, you know, like the start of a roller coaster.
Right.
And it kind of goes to the top, and the Barney lets go. And then the car is grabbed by a rotating piece. This is real Rube Goldberg. That thing lifts it up and then rotates it and dumps it into the pan, which collects the coal, and then there's a little arm that puts it in the ship. That was called a McMiller dumper. So one car at a time. Once the car was empty, it was rotated back, lowered down to the top of the roller coaster again, where it then was released by gravity. And it would go down the trestle, out usually toward the water, up to a kickback where there was a spring switch, and then it would come back to shore. So very hard to build one of those in real life, because if it's like doing a hump yard, it's hard to get the physics right. I mean, the physics are right. It's hard to simulate full-scale physics with a model with the gravity acceleration. So, all right, so McMiller dumpers were used for a long time, but those have gone out of favor because they took too long. And now you just have rotary dumpers that dump to conveyor belts, and then the conveyor belts go out along the pier to a lifting arm, which it's done with conveyors, will then gather the coal in a little bin, a surge bin, and then dump it in it. And that's pretty much what's used now. The question is, how do you store the coal? Because the ship may not be there when the train arrives.
Mm-hmm.
So for many years, they just stored the coal in the trains, in the train cars. And Norfolk Southern still does this down at Lambert Point. They have a capacity for 6,000 cars, and they store the coal right in the cars. And if you read their promotional material, they like it because they know the type of coal in every car. And the customer says, I want this percent of steam coal with this moisture content, this buttness, and this whatever. And they can blend it by saying, we want those cars and those cars and those cars. So for switching, it's great. You know, you got, and then their machines, they do the blending right at the pier. And then they have this, I forgot the name of the machine, but it's big. At one time, it was the biggest moving machine in the world.
Hmm.
And it would help load the ships. And that's still in operation down there. The CNO did something similar in Norfolk. But they switched to, the trains would come in, dump the coal on the ground, and they would dump the coal in piles that were the same kind of coal in each pile. And then when a ship came in, they would, if they wanted to blend, they would take it from each pile. And they had things called stackers and reclaimers, which looked like the stacker reclaimer, which is a combined device. It looks like a bucket wheel excavator. If you've ever seen the coal mines in Germany, have you ever seen these things where it's huge, looks like a round disc with buckets that dig into the ground as it spins?
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's what they use. So there's a they're around the country, but like Norfolk has them.
They're huge, those things.
Newport
News.
Well, the ones that the Germans use, the mining ones, are huge.
Yeah.
The stack reclaimers that are used for on the piers, at the coal piers, are a little more manageable. They're a little smaller.
Oh, all right.
There's pictures in the book. I've over the years, I've caught up pictures. I've taken them myself. I've risked being arrested on many ports. I risk it all for my readers. And then Norm, when we went down to see Norm that one time, so we're standing on the deck of this UNS Watson, which is, I don't know, 100-some feet up in the air, and we're looking right down on the coal terminal.
Well,
so I got great pictures of that coal terminal. So the best part of that trip, other than seeing Norm, who's a great guy, and I spent the night with Norm, and I helped him do, I forget, we did photography, was we got these great pictures of the coal terminal. So let's see, what else? Oh, the Ulets.
Right.
You asked about the Ulets.
Yeah.
The Ulets were a way to unload the ships. So now that we've got the ships loaded, we've got to get them unloaded. And again, in the old days, it was men with shovels. It evolved into something, and a lot of little things evolved in parallel, but one of the first ones was called a whirly jig, which was like a little bucket on a rotating arm, and so they could lower the bucket. And then that evolved into a clamshell that could open and dig and bite itself, so you didn't have to have people shoveling into the bucket. And so those are called grabs, and they're still in use. I have pictures in the book of a ship that was unloading road salt in Baltimore, and they were using a traveling arm with a grab to unload the ship. And then, unfortunately, they were dumping it into dump trucks, not trains. Mm. It would have been nice if they still used trains.
Yeah.
And the other thing is a Ulet. The Ulet evolved as a specialized machine to mostly do coal, or correction, ore, but also could do coal. And there was one in New York actually dug into garbage. It would unload garbage barges.
Really?
And, yeah. There were about 83 or so Ulets around the country. They were invented by this guy, Ulet. And their advantage was they were pretty fast. And they looked like grasshoppers going up and down and going into the ship. And there are pictures in the book, and it's easy because Walters made a great model of them in HO scale. And I don't think they made an N-scale model, but several people like Monroe Stewart did build some. Monroe, by the way, is an N-scale modeler in Maryland who is really into ships. So I went over to take pictures. He had just ships everywhere, including the Enterprise. He's building an N-scale Enterprise.
Oh, nice. What's the CV6 or 65?
The 65.
Okay. Wow. That's
it wasn't really finished when I was there, but he had like 10 F-14s on the deck and stuff. So, but anyway, Monroe has he made Ulets in N-scale. He also has the Great Lake car ferries in N-scale, too.
Wow. Very cool.
So, but I think we only end up using one picture from Monroe's ships in the book.
Gotcha. Well, getting back into it, and this is a subject that's going to be near and dear to Craig, and that is car floats. And I love describing car floats as kind of like a live interchange, basically. But if you could, give us some of the basic definition of a car float operation and really the advantages to modeling. And Craig, I'll be curious to hear your feedback on this as well.
Okay.
Well, when you say rail marine to people, model railroaders, this is what they think of. They think of car floats. But in the book, there's only one chapter on car floats, only half a chapter, because it's a lot more to the subject than just that. But one of the reasons for this is, this is my theory, There's two reasons. Is one, there's something innately interesting about switching a car float. It's, you know, change from the normal. There's a certain procedure you have to follow to keep the car loaded and not capsizing, or keep the barge loaded and not capsizing. And it's specialized equipment. There's loading gauge. So it's just cool. So a lot of people model them. The other thing is, that I think the why model railroaders love them, is because a lot of the railroads, especially in San Francisco and New York, had their own fleet of tugboats.
Yep.
And they were painted in the railroad colors. So that's just really cool to model railroaders. But to go back to your first question, car ferries versus car floats. The one way to look at it is a car ferry is like a land or a sea bridge. In other words, it's for moving a whole train from one spot to another. So the perfect example would be the Carnicas Strait in California, where they built the world's biggest railroad ferry out of wood. And it only went like a mile and a half, and it went from one side of the strait to the other side of the strait. And it could take, I think, 40 passenger cars plus the engine, and I forget how many freight cars, at one shot.
Wow.
And
it's a big ferry, yeah.
Yeah, and they were ferries. The first ferry was actually on the Susquehanna River in Maryland, Pennsylvania area there. It was called Maryland and the Pennsylvania. There are two ferries. And they would load a train onto the ferry. People would go up high, or I think that's how it worked. And it would go onto the side of Susquehanna and unload. But during the Civil War, that was a sort of a choke point. And so the Union government authorized or helped finance the railroad to build a bridge, but the bridge wasn't completed until after the Civil War. So think of a car ferry as a sea bridge for a whole train, whereas a car float is more involved in the final distribution of the car to a particular industry or other yards. Now, there's exceptions to both, and I in my talk I show examples of passenger trains that are moving on car floats and vice versa. But for the most part, that's a good working definition.
All right. Excellent.
Car floats were used around the country. Ferries were up and down. You had ferries on the Great Lakes. You had ferries on the Mississippi. You had ferries going from Florida to Havana. Ferries going from New York up to like where Craig's modeling. Mm-hmm. You still have ferries that go from Seattle to Alaska, and there's still a car ferry that goes from it moved around a little bit because of Hurricane Katrina, but it went from now it's going from Mobile to and I can't pronounce the name of this place in Mexico. It's like Oaxacelias or something, and it runs three times a week. It's huge. It takes like I don't know 100 something car ferries. So there's car ferries are everywhere, but they're still being used. Car floats were really common in New York and to a lesser extent in San Francisco and a few other places. Baltimore had them. Philadelphia had some. There were a few on the Great Lakes. But New York was the special case, and I talk about it in the book as a special case. And it's just the way the harbor was arranged. There was no direct rail line to the Long Island side, or no passenger line, I should say. Or correction, no freight line. There was a passenger line. So freight that wanted to get, and it's hard to believe now, but back, like right, I was born right at the tail end of it. But from like 1820 to like 1950s, New York was a heavily industrialized city all along the waterfront. The Navy Yard made warships. There were foundries that made boilers in Brooklyn. Any kind of industry, cans, printing presses, you name it, there were factories in New York that did it. The way they got their freight, if it came by rail and you arrived in most of the marshaling yards were in the New Jersey side, they would have to go all the way up to Albany, cross over on a bridge, come down the east shore, I guess, of the Hudson River, and they either go into New York, be unloaded at the New York Central, and then taken over by trucks or carts, or there was another little rail line that could kind of sneak around and come way around the back, kind of east of the harbor and come in. So it was a 3 or 4 day delay. So as early as 1866 or so, they saw what Herman Hoppe did. The first car ferry was in Alexandria in the Civil War, the thing that I've modeled on my layout and I talk about. And I built a model for the Lyceum. So Pennsylvania Railroad, I believe it was. I better check that, though. It's in the book. They built their first car float in New York. And what happened was all of the railroads developed their own little navies to handle car ferry operations. At one time, there were like 45 different transfer bridges where the car ferries would interface with the land. There was 3,000 workers involved. And the numbers are in the book. It was a lot. New York was like the biggest example of this. And the amazing thing is my dad tells me when he was a kid growing up in New York in like 1930, when he was about 6 years old, 5 years old, they would jump in the East River and swim amongst all this activity. And they would like go up by Harlem and jump in Harlem. And the current was so fast that they'd get out down by Wall Street. Anyway, these are not helicopter kids like they are today. Or helicopter parents, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, right. You know, the Depression, they had nothing else to do.
Right.
So there was
right.
a lot of stuff going on in New York, and a lot of people model it. And I have some examples. One of the most famous is Tim Morris, who did that, yeah. you know, custom track work at the New York Central, I think it was, freight terminal that he modeled. It was a pocket terminal. So
I think it's a Jersey Central terminal, actually.
Oh, New Jersey Central. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Actually, New York Central had the most car ferries and operations in New York, by the way, though. Wait a minute. Is that right, or is it New Haven? I forget now. It's in the book. I have to look it up. Anyway.
I'm not sure.
That's incentive for you
actually,
all to
you know
buy
what?
The
it
book,
was a New so Haven now that I think back on. New Haven had the most car ferries. But Penzi had a lot. B&O had them. Erie had them. New Jersey Central had them. And the pocket terminals are a neat little case because they're only served by car ferry. They don't have a land connection or by rail. There was one in Norfolk that I wrote about before that the C&O had. But there were several of them in New York, and they had some unusual track. So Tim picked a really strange one because he's an expert at track laying. But I like what Vince Lee did with his. He took two hollow-core doors and using commercial track components, built this really cool model of the 28th Street yard that Erie had.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, there's a typo in the book. His car float has three tracks, which is the standard New York design. But the drawing he sent me, it's not my fault. It's the drawing he sent me only had two tracks. And I copied the drawing he gave me. I'm thinking to myself, oh, well, he didn't do the standard because he didn't have room or whatever. I didn't know. I didn't even know to ask him. And then when he saw the proof book, he goes, oh, by the way, you blew the plans. Like, oh, okay. Sorry, Vince, but I think it's your fault, not my fault. Anyway.
Oh, that's funny.
But Vince's thing is really, his layout's really cool. And I think he told me he has to get rid of it. So if anybody wants to buy it, contact him.
Oh, okay.
Wow, okay. And Craig, if you would, just a little bit of your feedback. I'm guessing you're agreeing with, you would agree with what Bernie was talking about.
Of course.
Just the appeal of modeling it. And, but this kind of goes back, I mean, this goes, it's not as old as railroading, but I'm guessing it's a pretty old thing. I mean, you could be modeling in your day and age and have something like that.
Yeah? Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's no doubt. I mean, like Bernie's describing, the stuff was going on as early as the 1860s. So even by the time that my railroad comes around, it certainly was, you know, a very common thing to do, particularly in the area. You know, and in terms of modeling, it's fascinating and a lot of fun because, you know, it's an interchange. It's a industry that doesn't have any particular car type so that you can run all kinds of things to it. You can switch it over and over again during a session. You know, in terms of, you know, the usefulness of it on a model railroad, it's absolutely probably one of the best things you can do.
Yeah, excellent.
All right, I will give you some errata here. I checked.
Okay.
The first car ferry was not the Penzi. It was the New Jersey Central.
Okay.
In 1866.
All right.
And there's this guy named Starin who gets credit for it. He really wasn't the father of the operation, but he had, like, the leading business. And late in the 19th century, he sold everything to Erie. But actually, we would be remiss if we mentioned another guy who didn't give me any photos for the book, but who should have, was Dave Ramos.
Right.
Friend of the show. But he, you know, you got to have pretty pictures to do a book. So
yeah,
Dave's
yeah.
got great operations, but I'm not sure he has any scenes ready for pretty pictures. So
that's, yeah, I can't say. It's been a while since I've been over there, but I think you're right. I think you're right.
Right.
But there are some cool guys. You know, there are lots of people that model these things, and one of the ones that I really thought was cool was Barney, a guy named Bruce. let's see, what was it? Bruce Barney, I think, in Portland. And he did the Slocum Lake Ferry in Canada. And so the train comes in, loads the car ferry at the lake, and then he pushes a button, and the whole benchwork section that's the liquid, the water at the lake, goes up in the air and matches up with the upper level of the layout. And then you unload the ferry to the land and then go switch the industries. And I thought that was really cool.
Mm.
Yeah.
Bruce yeah, Barney is his name. So kind of like the other Barney. Anyway, we got to see that in Seattle. And Paul Dulcis has a nice car ferry operation on his layout. It's pretty. And there are dozens of others. There's some, you know, we just couldn't get them all in the book. Sure. And Walters did the kits. And so there are a lot of people that just bought the kits and added it on. So there's a lot of people who did it. Up at Springfield, I bumped into a guy who had a neat Fremo module of a terminal in the Philadelphia area. Actually, might be on the New Jersey side. I believe it was a Reading facility. Have you guys ever seen those modules?
No.
Yeah, really cool at all. It was like a not really a pocket terminal, but it all fit on like two 5-foot-long modules, maybe 10 feet long. And, it's a cool Fremo module. I can probably find out his name to give the man credit because I took a picture of his name tag.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
Gotcha. Good thinking.
Yeah, let's see if I can find. Yeah. So, James, a shout out to you for doing a great job on your. I guess he's New Jersey Fremo is his
okay.
thing.
Cool.
So, yeah, there's lots of people that have done really cool work there, and I hope people keep doing it. As Craig says, it's just fun. I've worked Paul's car float a few times. In fact, one day he was having an open house, so I had to do it over and over and over again.
Nice.
And it was pretty cool.
Don't throw me in the burn match, please.
You have to load the car in a certain sequence, and Paul has a neat little handy training aid, or not training is the wrong word, you know, operational aid that tells you the sequence you should do it.
Okay, excellent.
Now, what's interesting is I have a car ferry on my Aquia Landing Railroad, but my ferry is different than the modern ones. My cars are loaded across the center line of the ship or of the barge. It's two barges actually lashed together. And they have three ramps and they have eight cars. So you got to move the thing at least twice. So I don't think we're going to be moving the ferry during an op session.
Right.
Got you.
Most of us kind of come around to that choice.
Yeah, I think what will happen is there'll be like the ramps will be set for two tracks or three tracks or whatever it is. I guess on my layout it's only two. Up in Alexandria they had three, but I think they only had two. By the way, I have no photos of the transfer bridges at Aquia, so I don't really know what they look like.
But neither does anybody else. So
well, I'm assuming they had to have something.
Right.
So we're going to have like two transfer bridges. I'm going to basically copy what was in Alexandria and assume that was correct. It may not be. It may be a little simpler.
Right.
But there was a similar one-track transfer bridge at City Point, so they probably used a standard. So we're going with that.
Sounds good.
So what I'll probably do is when you're working the ferry, you'll actually only put two cars on the ferry, but you'll line the other six up on the tracks in the sequence that they've got to go.
Okay.
So that'll be your job. And so when you're working the ferry, that's what you'll do.
I like it. Makes sense.
And there was only one ferry a day in my railroad. I actually have the records for it. So it was one up and one back every day.
Very good. Okay.
It's going to be a cool layout.
Yeah. You hear that? Y'all
I believe it. I can't wait to come down and play with it.
The Aqua Line needs more love. Sorry, I can't let it go.
By the way, I was basing some of this on my YouTube visits.
Yeah.
There's a video on YouTube for Pola that's got like 90,000 views.
Right.
And the best the Aquia Landing's got are 2,000 or 3,000.
Well, there's no doubt there's an awful lot more people who are, you know, modeling the modern era, you know.
Yeah. That must be just the accessibility. Well, Bernie, I would love for you to talk a little bit about barges because this is one area of the maritime world that I really didn't have any knowledge in. So your book was pretty much the sole education that I've had on it. And talk about us all. So many of us probably really have an underappreciation of barges and the scope of what they can carry.
Now, let me just barge right in there.
Yes.
I say in the book that the barges are the unsung heroes of transportation world because, like you said, most people are completely oblivious to them, and yet they haul 15% of all tonnage is done in barges. And it's very cheap, it's very economically feasible, and it's also environmentally good, because the one tugboat can push a lot of stuff.
Yep.
With a small crew and so on. So, yeah, there's a little section on barges, and what's cool about barges and barge loading terminals is that you could have a barge loading terminal in the middle of grain country. If there's a river that's navigable, there's a chance, and there's a railroad that crosses it, they probably have a barge terminal. There are hundreds of them up and down the river, and they can be very simple. They could be just like a little, a lot of times you'll just see these round concrete pylons. They're not really pylons. They're bigger. They look like cofferdams. They may be 30 feet in diameter. There may be like three of them, and that's a barge terminal. The barge will come in and tie up to those things, and then they'll either use a bucket, you know, clamshell bucket to get at it, or they'll drive a forklift out and do it by hand if it's a really small one. But in the book, I picked one in Evansville, Indiana, because I actually went to Evansville, Indiana one time to operate a layout. And I saw the car, cool, the operation there, and then I did a little research and found out that they had this really cool covered shed for loading cars, or loading freight cars and barges and vice versa. And I contacted them, and they sent me photos of these from like the 30s of when this operation was going, where they were loading like the old style cars, and they would lift them in the air and then put them out on a barge and load them on the barge. And I said, oh, this is so cool. I got to put this in the book. And it's still used. It's still there. So you could do whatever area you want. You could model that barge loading facility. But there were a couple others I looked at that I drew up track plans. There was one that would work on a 4x8 based on 4x8 foot and HO based on a little spot in Kentucky where they actually have a little loop that goes around. It comes up to the river and loop makes a loop. And there are like four industries right along this loop. So it would be the perfect 4x8 layout because you would be switching four industries, you know, in a little loop.
Sure. Nice.
So that was cool, but again, you run out of room. I only have one plan in the book for the barge terminal. So barges should get more love.
Yeah, I agree now.
Mm-hmm. Anybody that lives on the Mississippi is going to see barges, or the Ohio.
Right.
Or the Missouri.
Mm-hmm. Or the Hudson.
Okay, yeah. Good. And also, mm-hmm. like the Mattapony. Do you even know where the Mattapony River is? It's in Virginia.
I do not.
Yeah, the Mattapony is the river that supports the West Point paint. The West Point is a city, and there's a paper mill there. It keeps changing names. The last time I looked, it was Lawrence, but it may not be that anymore. Okay. And they get barges with wood chips.
All right, cool. Well, what I'd like to hear now, and you talked about this a little bit before, but I mean, let's talk about the girl that seems to be getting all the loving is Miss Pola here, the Port of Los Angeles. That's getting all the loving here. So what inspired you?
The bell of the ball.
Yeah, exactly. So. Obviously, your inspiration is the real life port I'm missing. But what was specifically inspired you to go to choose this particular one to go with? And then I'd also love to know this is the third iteration of Chase Marine Terminal. Did you have like a real life prototype that you may have used to sort of for guidelines, if you will?
Well, that's an interesting point. The first Chase Marine was based loosely on Port Arthur, Texas, which has a single siding along. It's on sort of a intracoastal waterway, but it has access to the ocean. So that my first one was based on Port Arthur. This last one is more generic. I just wanted a place where the rail came right up to the ship, and the rest of Pola in my layout doesn't have one of those. So I did that. There are plenty of places on Los Angeles where that happens, but I wanted one on my layout. So Pola really is Mormon Island. In Los Angeles. So Los Angeles is the biggest port in the United States. It's, if you count all activity, it could be the third busiest port in the world, although the Asian ports are getting really big. I talk about this in my talk. Shanghai is building a container terminal 30 miles offshore, connected by a bridge. They built a bridge out to a man-made island. They made this huge island. They're spending $15 billion, and when it's done, that one island will have more capacity than the whole United States.
Holy
so, I mean,
moly.
China, I mean, we in the United States maybe not realize it, but we are going to lose our number one spot in a lot of things pretty quickly. But anyway, going back to Pola. So if you look at Los Angeles, there's these massive container terminals. And if you're going to do an HO, it's very hard. You have space. I don't have a genius. So I picked the one spot in Los Angeles Harbor that doesn't have containers.
Nice.
that's how I picked it. And I went there. I knew about this place from sort of Google Recon, you know, Google Maps Recon. I knew about it. And then when I went out to Los Angeles, I told you guys that whole story earlier about the insurance. But I got good pictures, and BSNF said, oh, Bernie's here. Let's run a bunch of trains down there for him. So I got pictures of all these Dana trains switching, Pasha, and they weren't switching the Borax Terminal. The cars were parked for the Borax Terminal. So I got to see it. I got some videos. And so I said, okay, this is kind of what I want to do for the book. It's modern. So that's how – that was the inspiration. So basically, it's the only place – the only terminal Long Island in Los Angeles. You got to be careful because Los Angeles and Long Beach are right next to each other, and they're really one port, but they kind of distinguish themselves. So it's the only port in Los Angeles that doesn't get containers. And even that's not true because it does get containers, but containers can be considered breakbulk cargo because 53-foot containers, which are used on domestic highways in the United States, cannot be put on conventional ocean-going
container ships. So you got to have another place to unload those.
So they get put in the holds of breakbulk, or what they call general purpose ships. Breakbulk ships is another name. So the day I was there, Gearbulk had this probably 180 meter long breakbulk ship. I think it was called the Finch Arrow, and it was unloading EMP. You know, the green containers.
Mm-hmm.
Brand new EMP containers were coming out of the hold.
Wow!
And being put on little tractors and being stacked right where Bernie was.
Nice.
So it was cool. So I do have on my layout, I have brand new containers. They're not weathered because they just came off the ship. They're brand new, and they'll be picked up by trucks and taken out by trucks probably. Right. But Ramon has a container train, so we may have pictures of an occasional container train coming down and doing something. Because there are some 40-footers laying around, so occasionally they do ship some 40-footers.
Right. And Bernie, you have your blog covers a lot of your construction with Pola, and you even have a YouTube video on it, you were saying?
Yeah, a couple.
Yeah, great. That's fantastic. Before I go to question 8, I can't believe I forgot to – I think actually when I was looking at my handwritten notes, I did have this and I just forgot to transcribe it. Touch a little bit, if you would, of just how much containerization changed everything. And this is kind of a curveball question. I didn't prep you for this one, but I figured you'd probably be able to wing this one a little bit.
It changed everything. You're right. It all started with McLean, who was a trucker in North Carolina. And he's a smart guy. And he came up to New York one day, and I heard conflicting reports, either cigarettes or cotton. And they made him wait a week to unload his truck.
Right.
And so while he's sitting there, he says, got to be a better way. And so a couple of years later, after World War II, he put together the formula. And this was in the era of regulation. So the shipping industry, the railroad industries, they were anything but innovative because everything was being regulated by the government. So he had to fight regulations. He had capital. He had the technology. He figured out the technology. It wasn't that complicated. But probably the number one thing was the interlocking disconnects that connect the containers together.
Right.
That was a key. It's a small piece of technology, but that was the key. He hired engineers to do that. But he had we had tenacity to overcome the sort of ingrained shipping and railroads because everybody was against them. The unions were against them. Everybody was against them. But he also had the thing that was most important. He had customers.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a trucking industry. So he would go up to his clients and say, look, I can get this from New York to Houston on my ship for a third of the price or whatever whatever it was. And so the customers were willing to take a flyer on it. And so he built and the other thing that happened, which was kind of cool, is World War II is over. The United States Merchant Marine is huge. There's thousands and thousands of ships. And so they were selling them for dirt cheap. So we got T2 tankers from World War II, dirt cheap. So the first container ship was actually a converted T2 tanker. And to show you how smart he was and clever, he said, well, we'll leave the oil in the bottom, in the hull. Let's just put the containers on the top.
Ah, okay.
So they built a deck on top of all the valves and stuff, and that's where the first set of containers went, which were like 23-foot containers. They were an oddball size. And it took off. And the unions went crazy because they could see that they were going to lose all these jobs of all these men working in the breakbulk field. So there was a lot of fighting with the unions. The ports were saying, oh, my God, we got to buy cranes and dredge. So they didn't really want it. But it was just such a good idea that everyone had to come around.
Mm.
But a little anecdote, which is not in the book. There was a port in South America, I think in Venezuela, Caracas, I believe it was. There was a container ship showed up, and the longshoreman refused to unload it for 2 years.
Oh, wow. Wow.
That's union opposition.
Wow. Oh,
so the boat actually got stuck in the port for that long? They couldn't leave?
I think it may have, because the cargo, they didn't want the cargo back. I'll have to double check that. That's talked about in the book. There's a book called The Box, which talks about it. And there's another book, forget the name of the other one. I'm looking at my bookshelf, but I don't see it. There were two books that cover the sort of development. One is sort of ship-oriented, and the other one's more economic-oriented. Mm. So they're both pretty good.
Mm. Okay.
But the other thing I was going to mention is, has everyone seen the movie On the Waterfront? Or most people have seen that movie with Marlon Brando.
Right, right.
And that shows that gives you sort of the tail end of the breakbulk era. But that went on for years. It was the same in every country. In the United States, it was called shaping. So getting a crew to work on a ship was called shaping. And it was rife with corruption and kickbacks and all kinds of nasty stuff.
Right.
In Baltimore is interesting. The Polish ethnic group ran the operation, and they were very efficient. So the shippers didn't want to mess with it. So the shippers were perfectly happy to live with these guys because they kept their act together, you know. But in other cities, it wasn't quite as well organized, and so the shipping companies would push them. But there wasn't much they could do. There were a lot of strikes. Mm-hmm. Anyway, when the containers came, what basically had to happen was the savings from the containers was not initially all realized by the shipping companies. A portion of that savings was taken and paid toward the union workers so that they could have retirements and stuff and health insurance and so on. And they gradually phased it out. So it was relatively fair.
Okay.
Depending on your viewpoint, you know, I mean, you can't just, I don't think you should, just fire everybody.
Right.
So they worked it out.
Right. Right.
Now, the longshoremen are they're still important. We recently had a strike in Los Angeles. And I've been studying the container traffic flows, and the container traffic in the United States dropped as a result of the L.A. strike. But they sorted out, and now the longshoremen work the trucks and the cranes.
Okay. Wow. And that makes...
They don't have to carry... And it's much safer for them. They're not getting hurt as much. Right. It's a much safer process. And the other interesting thing about it is the cost to ship something didn't change that much since, like, from the 80s. Now,
okay,
with the pavilion. But what has changed is the other aspects of logistics have become much more reliable and secure. So you have less theft, you have less breakage, you know where your stuff is, you know, in route and so on.
Right.
So you can do just in time. So you save money on inventory. So there are a lot of other non-transportation savings that they made.
Okay.
So it's an interesting question. From a model railroad perspective, though, it sucks.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, guys, we are getting the shaft on this, right?
Right.
To model container terminals really tough.
Right.
So, but in my book, I do have some ways around it.
Right, right.
And you basically pick a small place.
Right. That makes sense. Let me just...
No, it's got its...
if you want to model containers, you got to do N-scale.
That's the scale to do it in, that's for sure.
So, Bernie, is it fair to say that in a way, what McLean did is, it almost looks like he was sort of like the father of freight movement becoming more of a transportation business as opposed to just isolated shipping, rail, and trucking businesses. Like, I feel like there's a lot of...
Yeah, that's a good observation, Tim. You are a smart guy.
Oh, well. I wouldn't go that far.
No, you're right, because McLean could give a rat's poodle about ships. Mm-hmm. Ships were just a way to move his boxes around.
Right.
And that's why he used the second, but I said the T2 tanker was the first one.
Right.
The second one were the C2 class ships, which were like Liberty ships, but the next design. Mm-hmm. So like a general cargo ship. And he converted those. And that one they actually took the holds and put the cellular racks in. So that became the prototype for the current container ship, where the boxes actually go in the hull.
Right. Gotcha.
And so from a modeling perspective, this is a good thing because you can get a T2 in 196 scale. I'm not sure about a C2, but you can get a C2. You can't get the C4. And the reason I want to get a C4 is because I actually spent a night on a C4 when my uncle but that's different. So if you wanted to do like an early container ship, you could just go get one of the military boats from World War II and okay. modify it to a container terminal or container ship. But yeah, Tim, you're right. And it's actually getting even more so because with consolidation industry now, there's an excess capacity in container shipping. And so a lot of the shipping industry, Hanjin last year went bankrupt.
Yep.
Probably heard about that.
I did.
I think Maersk has been buying up a lot of other ones. Maersk just bought another one of the ones. So there's been consolidation. It's kind of like in the railroads, you know, we have the big five or big six. The container ships are going the same way. And with the ships, it's gotten even crazy, the size of the container ships. They're bigger than aircraft carriers now.
Which is impressive, very impressive.
400 meters long, huge ships. So, in fact, some of these ships are so big, the United States economy is really not big enough for them.
Wow.
Which makes you think, what the heck's going on? So these ships go from Asia to Europe. They're not worth going from Asia to the United States. The Ben Franklin, which was CGMA's big ship, it made a couple visits to L.A., highly publicized, and then it was pulled off and went to do the Trans-Asia to Europe routes because that's where the big economy is, longer trip, and they can use the Suez Canal. And so it's worth it to have those super big ships over there. We don't really need them to just go across the little piddly Pacific.
Right.
Which is the biggest ocean in the world. I know that, people. I know it. I'm just
Well, speaking of ships, then, that kind of leads to our final question for you tonight, and that is, you know, and you've spoken a little bit about the availability of some of the models, like for the T2s and C2s. But sometimes you really just got to, you know, build a ship and talk about how you went about it and, you know, and any other options out there that you feel like would be worth mentioning.
Well, there are some kits available that make it easy. Sylvan has one. Barraco is a company that makes, been making them for many years. So those are mostly lake boats. Architect in the Netherlands sells a lot of like Euro-style coaster type boats, which really aren't right for the United States, but it's possible that one or two came over here. And there are a couple other Frenchman Model Works. They make car ferries, car floats and stuff. So there are lots of options there. But if you want to do big container ships, big tankers, you're much more limited. And what I did was I looked to the radio control market, where they have 196 scale boats or ships, and I bought one from Dean's Marine in England. It cost me almost as much to ship it as it did to buy the kit. And I ended up only using the hull and the detail parts. I ended up scratch building the whole rest of it with using my laser, of course, but you didn't have to. And it was a fiberglass hull, which I was very surprised how easy it is to cut with a motor tool. It's very strong, but it's very light and very soft and easy to cut. And so I was able to cut at the waterline and build a deck and a false deck on the bottom and build it on the layout, build a superstructure, put my hatches. I scratch built my cranes to a particular prototype. There's two cranes on the ship because it's a break bulk ship. And I named it after my daughter. And I think it came out really good, but I really wanted a bigger one. So I'm doing this big bulk carrier next.
Nice.
This might scratch the itch, though. I may actually make that itch sore on this one. This has been a lot of work just to get the hull done. They, by the way, Dean's Marine does sell a bulk carrier hull. It's 69 inches long, and it's 12 inches wide, so it was a little wide for my pier. And it's only 130 pounds, which isn't too bad, considering it's like a rowboat that you get in almost. But to ship here was 330 pounds.
Oh.
Wow.
That's a pretty significant investment.
Yeah. And so what the guy was pretty cool. The guy says, well, what people typically do is they buy a bunch of them and gang them together because apparently it's just sort of the size of the box and they can stack a bunch in. It's not the weight that's the issue.
Right.
So I said, well, what if you cut it in half? Because there was like a size thing. And that would have dropped the shipping to 90 pounds. Because I'm going to just cut the bottom of the boat off. I'm not using it as a radio-controlled boat. I'm using it as a static model. So for 90 pounds, they would have shipped it. So that's about the time that my brother and I got hooked up and we did the wood thing. So I didn't buy it. But in retrospect, I'm thinking, I should have just bought that thing. First of all, the wood for the boat that I bought, that was $60.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent, there's fiberglass, or correction, acrylic decking, which I probably would have had to buy that anyway. Who knows? I guess it was cheaper to do it.
Right.
I had to pay $36 to ship it, you know, from Florida up to New York. So it would have almost been a wash. If you count labor, I would have saved a lot of labor. But then I would have had the problem of having a 12-inch wide, 69-inch long boat, and my pier really is only like 65 inches long. So as it is, I'm going to have to shave the wharf a little bit, because right now the edge of the boat rubs right along the edge of the benchwork in one little spot. And it's a choke point on the layout, so like your sleeve and stuff will catch the handrails and stuff. So I'm going to shave an inch off the wharf because it's just foam and extend the water over an inch. And that will give me like an inch of an inch of clearance between the edge of the hull and the benchwork.
Got ya. Okay. Excellent. All right.
The other interesting thing about the ship is where it's located in my layout is it's going to act like a view block.
Okay.
The ship with its superstructure and its hull, and then where the hull is low, the silos come in. All of that will act like a view block. So when you're standing in Pola's pit, you know, the operating pit by Pola, and you look across, you really won't see the Civil War layout that clearly.
Okay.
Because this big, massive ship and grain silo thing is going to be in the way. So, anyway, I just threw that out there.
Very cool.
That's why I didn't put up a skyboard or anything.
You didn't need to. You got a shipboard.
Of course, if you're standing in a quay and you look across, you'll see these paddle wheel steamers, and you'll see this great big freighter.
Just don't look too far.
Yeah. Don't look that way. Look the other way.
Excellent. All right, Bernie, thanks for coming on with us, and we're going to exit the roundhouse, and we're going to talk to you in the end there. So just stay with us, listeners.
Okay.
We'll be right back. Well, Bernie, thanks for coming on and discussing that with us. It's a great book. I read it. I heartily recommend it. It's a fantastic book. I can't wait to leave a review on Amazon. And one thing I noticed that in your book that you brought up a couple of times, and it's worth bringing up in here, is for some of these detail parts, you could go to a certain Alcom scale models to help you out. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, the fences are the biggie. Mm-hmm. However, there's a new one in the works. For the ship, I need a lot of handrails and stairs with landings. And for the silo has an exterior stair that goes up with landings. So I went ahead and etched them,
okay.
And they're in progress.
Nice.
So those will be available. And the etching, I had Brad Trenkamp came over one night, and he said, you know what I need are those back savers for the switches that they look like a sort of a bow tie, half of a bow tie.
Oh, yeah. It's like a big, big pipe.
So there was a little room in the bottom of the fret, so I put four of those in there. And I also put in a ladder with a safety cage and a landing, because those are also on my grains, my Borax silos. And there was one other bonus piece in there. Oh, a couple watertight doors that have a round wheel dog them down. There's two styles. There's like the wheel style. And then there's a style where you kind of like turn little levers and lock the doors.
Yep.
So I went with the wheel style. So there's two. So there's a couple bonuses. So you get 400 feet of fence of railings, handrails, two landings and stairwells, a safety cage and ladder, and then these other little bonus parts I just mentioned. So it should be pretty cool.
And I'm assuming that's an N scale?
No, this is HO scale.
Ooh, okay. I'm going to have to check that out.
The thing about my boat is, the boat is true HO scale, not 1/96.
Okay.
So if you use like the 1/96 parts, things look, they're a little small. They're 10% off.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a new Alchem kit. Plus for the book and for Pola, I needed a lot of fences. So I need these stainless steel photo etched fences with gates, and all the gates on Pola work, which they're made from the stainless steel. And I've been selling a lot of those, and people have asked for them in bulk. And so you can get up to 12 at a time, and you get like 40% off if you buy 12. And I've actually had like three or four people do that already. So they're selling pretty good. They come with the barbed wire built in. And that's really the only two things I have right now that relate directly to the book. I may have some other things eventually. I don't know. We'll see.
Right.
I also sell my book on my website. If you want me to sign your book and mail it to you, You can't really do it with Amazon unless you see me in person.
Right.
So, or you could, some people, I suppose you could buy it, mail it to me, and send it back. I don't know. But if you buy the book from my website, I will sign it for you.
Wonderful.
Awesome. That's great. Well, Bernie, thanks so much for coming on. We're always excited to get you on, and I know Thomas Gazier was busting on you a little bit,
when I retire, I could be your co-host.
There you go. Well, we're always happy to have you here, and I'm just really excited about this book. I'm definitely going to be going through it again. And as I told you on the phone, it's definitely going to have some relevancy towards me, especially with future projects with the Model Railroad. There's definitely more of a waterfront operation to the PRSL that I wanted to work in, and this is probably going to help me get some of that done. So
outstanding, yeah.
Well, one little plug here. Next weekend, if you're going to be in the Tulsa, Oklahoma area, I'll be doing two talks. I'll be talking about Acquire Landing, Acquire Railroad, and I'll be talking about the book. It's called NMRA OPSIG Weekend, something like that.
Cool.
So there's a link on my blog if you want to go down. So I'll be down there. And then actually in April, I'll be doing a talk in Fairfax Station on modeling railroads of the Civil War, too. I might be in uniform for that one. The general may show up.
Cool.
Nice.
It's the right time of the year for it. So.
Yeah, that thing's really warm, so it's going to be wrong. The summer's coming, and it's hot in Virginia.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Very good. All right, fellas. Well, listen, thank you both so much. Craig, thanks for being the co-pilot.
Of course.
Keeping the plane in the air, or the train on the ground.
That's what I do.
Bernie, thank you again, and we'll be curious. We're looking forward to having you on in the future, and because I'm sure you've got other things that are going to be happening soon as well. So,
yeah, I didn't even mention the next book. We'll talk about that next time.
Yeah, we're looking forward to that, seeing what else is you got going. I enjoyed listening to you. You were on Lionel's show, the AML, and so it was interesting hearing a little bit about the process that you go through with Kallenbach to figure out what you're going to publish. So,
yeah, a bunch of ON30 stuff showed at my house lately.
Ah, okay.
Ooh, that's interesting.
That's a teaser.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And today's standard gauge O-scale boxcar showed up.
Oh, boy.
Oh, man.
Weird.
What's going on, folks?
Dave's not here.
All right.
And, of course, what we opened the show with, we closed the show with. The Model Railcast theme. Until next time, guys.
You've been listening to the Model Railcast Show. You can find us at www.modelrailcastshow.com or on Facebook at Friends of MRCS, and look for us on iTunes. Don't miss your other great model railroading podcasts out there, The Scotty Mason Show, Model Rail Radio, A Modeler's Life, and the Model Railroad Hobbyist Podcast. And drop us a line if we miss mentioning you. This is Amy Perkins for the Model Railcast Show. Have a great week.